Chapter 2. Ancirca. Duty measures the distance between the animal and the divine. Ecyanus 1, 44 Epistles. The days and weeks before battle are a strange thing. All the contingents, the Conraians, the Galioth, the Nansur, the Thunieri, the Tidoni, the Aenoni, and the Scarlet Spires march to the fortress of Asgiliac, to the Southron gates and the heathen frontier. As though many bent their thoughts to Scaurus, the heathen Sapatishah who would contest us, he was still woven of the same cloth as a thousand other abstract concerns. One could still confuse war with everyday living. Drusus Acamian, Compendium of the First Holy War. Late Spring, 4111, Year of the Tusk, the province of Ancirca. For the first few days of the march, everything had been confusion, especially at sunset, when the Enrethi scattered across field and hillside to make camp. Unable to find Zynemus and too tired to care, Acamian had even pitched his tent among strangers a couple of nights. As the Conraian host grew accustomed to itself as a host, however, collective habit, combined with the gravity of fealty and familiarity, ensured that the camp took more or less the same shape every evening. Soon Acamian found himself sharing food and banter, not only with Zynemus and his senior officers, Erissus, Dinchases, and Zenkapa, but with Kellis, Serwe, and Neyor as well. Proyas visited them twice. Difficult evenings for Acamian, but usually the crown prince would summon Zynemus, Kellis, and Neyor to the royal pavilion, either for temple or for evening councils with the other great lords of the Conraian contingent. As a result, Acamian often found himself stranded with Erissus, Dinchases, and Zenkapa. They made for awkward company, especially with a timid beauty such as Serwe in their midst. But Acamian soon began to appreciate these nights, particularly after spending his days marching with Kellis. There would be the shyness of men meeting in the absence of their traditional brokers, then the rush of affable discourse, as though surprised and delighted they spoke the same language. It reminded him of the relief he and his childhood friends had felt whenever their older brothers had been called to the boats or the beaches. The fellowship of overshadowed souls was something Acamian could understand. Since leaving Momum, it seemed the only moments of peace he found were with these men, even though they thought him damned. One night, Zynemus took Kellis and Serwe to join Proyas in celebration of Venicata, an Enrethi holy day. Erissus and the others departed soon after to join their men, and for the first time, Acamian found himself alone with the Skilvendi, Neyor Ur-Skiotha, the last of the Utumut. Even after several nights of sharing the same fire, the Skilvendi barbarian unnerved him. Sometimes, glimpsing him in his periphery, Acamian would involuntarily catch his breath. Like Kellis, Neyor was a wraith from his dreams, a figure from a far more treacherous ground. Add to this his many scarred arms and the koray he kept stuffed beneath his iron-plated girdle. But there were so many questions he needed to ask. Regarding Kellis mostly, but also regarding the Srank clans to the north of his tribal lands. He even wanted to ask the man about Serwe. The way she doted on Kellis, yet followed Neyor to sleep, had been noticed by all. On those nights the three retired early, Acamian could see the gossip and the looks exchanged by Erissus and the others, though they had yet to share their speculations. When he'd asked Kellis about her, the man had simply shrugged and said, "She's his prize." For a time, Acamian and Neyor simply did their best to ignore each other. Shouts and cries echoed through the darkness, and shadowy clots of revelers filed along the unbounded edges of their firelight. Some stared, gawked even, but for the most part left them alone. After scowling at a boisterous party of Conraian knights, Acamian finally turned to Neyor and said, "I guess we're the heathens, eh, Skilvendi?" An uncomfortable silence followed while Neyor continued gnawing at the bone he held. Acamian sipped his wine, thought of excuses he might use to withdraw to his tent. What did one say to a Skilvendi?
"So you teach him," Neyor suddenly said, spitting gristle into the fire.
His eyes glittered from the shadow of his heavy brows, studying the flames. "Yes,"
Akamian replied.
Has he told you why?
Akamian shrugged. He seeks knowledge of the three seas. Why do you ask? But the Skilvendi was already standing, wiping greasy fingers against his breeches, then stretching his giant, sinuous frame. Without a word, he strode off into the darkness, leaving Akamian baffled. Short of speaking, the man hadn't acknowledged him in any way. Akamian resolved to mention the incident to Kellis when he returned, but he quickly forgot the matter. Against the greater scheme of his fears, bad manners and enigmatic questions were of little consequence. Akamian typically pitched his humble wedge tent beneath the weathered slopes of Zynemus's pavilion. Without exception, he would spend hours lying awake, his thoughts either choked by recriminations regarding Kellis or smothered by the deranged enormity of his circumstances. And when these things passed into numbness, he would fret over Esmonette or worry about the Holy War. Too soon, it seemed, it would wander into Fainim lands, into battle. The nightmares were becoming more unbearable. Scarcely a night passed where he didn't awaken long before the cockcrow horns, thrashing at his blankets or clawing his face, crying out to ancient comrades. Few Mandate schoolmen enjoyed anything resembling peaceful slumber. Esmonette had once joked that he slept like an old hound chasing rabbits. Try an old rabbit, he'd replied, fleeing hounds. But sleep, or the absolute oblivious heart of it anyway, began to elude him altogether, until it seemed he simply shuffled from one clamor to another. He would crawl from his tent into the pre-dawn darkness, hugging himself to still the tremors, and he would simply stand as the blackness resolved into a cold, colorless version of the vista he'd seen the previous evening, watching the sun's golden rim surface in the east like a coal burning through painted paper. And it would seem he stood upon the very lip of the world, that if it tipped by the slightest measure, he would be cast into an endless black. So alone, he would think. He would imagine Esmonette sleeping in their room and Sumna, one slender leg kicked from the covers, banded by threads of light, as the same sun boiled through the cracks of her shutters. And he would pray that she was safe, pray to the gods who damned them both. One sun keeps us warm, one sun lets us see, one... Then he would think of Anassarimber Kellis, thoughts of anticipation and dread. One evening, while listening to others argue about the Fainim, Akamian suddenly realized there was no reason to suffer his fears alone. He could tell Zynemus. Akamian glanced across the fire at his old friend, who was arguing battles that had yet to be fought.
Certainly Naor knows the heathen, the marshal was protesting. I never said otherwise. But until he sees us on the field, until he sees the might of Conraya, neither I nor our prince, I suspect, will take his word as scripture.
Could he tell him? The morning after the madness beneath the Emperor's palace had also been the morning the Holy War began its march. Everything had been confusion. Even still, Zynemus had made Akamian his priority, fairly interrogating him on the details of the previous night. Akamian had started with the truth, or a hollowed-out version of it anyway, saying that the Emperor had required independent verification of certain claims made by his imperial sake. But what followed was pure fantasy, some story about finding the ciphers to an ensorcelled map. Akamian could no longer remember. At the time, the lies had simply happened. The events of that night and the revelations that followed had been too immediate and far too catastrophic in their implications. Even now, 2 weeks later, Akamian felt overmatched by their dread significance. Back then, he could only flounder. Stories, on the other hand, were something he could make sense of, something he could speak. But how could he explain this to Zynemus, to the one man who believed, who trusted? Akamian watched and waited, glancing from face to illuminated face. He'd purposely unrolled his mat on the smoky side of the fire, hoping for a measure of solitude while he ate. Now it seemed that Providence had placed him here, affording him a furtive glimpse of the whole. There was Zynemus, of course, seated knees out and back upright like a Zayumi warlord, the hard set of his mouth betrayed by the laughter in his eyes and the crumbs in his square-cut beard. To his left, his cousin, Arissus, rocked to and fro upon the trunk of a felled tree, so much like a big-pawed puppy in his exuberance, bullying as much as the patience of the others would allow. Sitting to his left, Dinchazes, or Bloody Dinch, held out his wine bowl for the slaves to refill, the X-shaped scar on his forehead inked black by the shadows. Zenkappa, as usual, sat by his side, his ebony skin shining in the firelight. For some reason, his manner and tone never ceased to remind a Kamian of a mischievous wink. Kellis sat cross-legged nearby, wearing a plain white tunic and looking for all the world like a portrait plundered from some temple, at once meditative and attentive, remote and absorbed. Serwe leaned against him, her eyes shining beneath drowsy lids, a blanket pulled across her thighs. As always, the flawlessness of her face arrested, and the curves of her figure tugged. Close to her, but back farther from the fire, Nayur crouched in the shadows, gazing at the flames and tearing mouthful after mouthful of bread. Even eating, he looked ready to break necks. Such a strange tribe. His tribe. Could they feel it, he wondered? Could they feel the end coming? He had to share what he knew, if not with the Mandate, then with someone. He had to share or he would go mad. If only Esme had come with... No, that way lay more pain. He set down his bowl, stood, and before he realized it, found himself sitting next to his old friend, Krijeti Zynemis, the Marshal of Atrempas. Zin.
What is it, Akka?
I must speak with you, he said in a hushed voice. There's... Kellis seemed distracted. Even still, a Kamian couldn't shake the sense of being observed. That night, he continued, that last night beneath Momem's walls, do you remember Ikuri Confis coming for me, escorting me to the Emperor's palace?
How could I forget? I was worried sick.
A Kamian hesitated. Glimpsed images of an old man, the Emperor's prime counsel, convulsing against chains. Glimpses of a face unclutching like hands and flexing outward, reaching, a face that grasped, that seized. Zynema studied him by firelight, frowned.
What's wrong, Akka? I'm a schoolman, Zin, bound by oath and duty the same as you— Lord Cousin!
Orissus called over the flame.
You must listen to this. Tell him, Kellis. Please, cousin,
Zynemis replied sharply.
Can't you? Fah, just listen to him. We're trying to understand what this means.
Zynemis began scolding the man, but it was already too late. Kellis was speaking. It's just a parable, the Prince of Atrathal said. Something I learned while among the Skilvendi. It goes like this. A slender young bull and his harem of cows are shocked to discover that their owner has purchased another bull. Far deeper of chest, far thicker of horn, and far more violent of temper. Even still, when the owner's sons drive the mighty newcomer to pasture, the young bull lowers his horns, begins snorting and stamping.
No, his cows cry. Please don't risk your life for us. Risk my life, the young bull exclaims. I'm just making sure he knows I'm a bull.
A heartbeat of silence, then an explosion of laughter.
A Skilvendi parable?
Zynemis cried out, laughing.
Are you sh—
This is my opinion, Orissus called through the uproar. My interpretation. Listen, it means that our dignity, no, our honor, is worth more than anything, more than even our wives.
It means nothing,
Zynemis said, wiping tears from his eyes.
It's a joke, nothing more. It is a parable of courage.
Nayor grated. And everyone fell silent. Shocked, a Kamian supposed, that the taciturn barbarian had actually spoken. The man spat into the fire.
It is a fable that old men tell boys in order to shame them, to teach them that gestures are meaningless, that only death is real.
Looks were exchanged about the fire. Only Zenkappa dared laugh aloud. A Kamian leaned forward.
What do you say, Kellis? What do you think it means?
Kellis shrugged, apparently surprised he held the answer so many had missed. He matched Akamian's gaze with friendly, yet utterly implacable eyes. It means that young bulls sometimes make good cows. More gales of laughter, but Akamian could manage no more than a smile. Why was he so angry?
No, he called out.
What do you think it really means? Kellis paused, clasped Serway's right hand, and looked from face to shining face. Akamian glanced at Serway, only to look away. She was watching him, intently.
It means, Kellis said in a solemn and strangely touching voice, that there are many kinds of courage and many degrees of honor. He had a way of speaking that seemed to hush all else, even the surrounding holy war. It means that these things, courage, honor, even love, are problems, not absolutes, questions.
Orissus shook his head vigorously. He was one of those dull-witted men who continually confused ardor with insight. Watching him argue with Kellis had become something of a sport.
Courage, honor, love? These are problems? Then what are the solutions? Cowardice and depravity?
Orissus, Zynemus said half-heartedly. Cousin.
No, Kellis replied. Cowardice and depravity are problems as well. As for the solutions, you, Orissus, you're a solution. In fact, we're all solutions. Every life lived sketches a different answer, a different way.
So are all solutions equal?
Akamian blurted. The bitterness of his tone startled him.
A philosopher's question, Kellis replied, and his smile swept away all awkwardness. No, of course not. Some lives are better lived than others, there can be no doubt. Why do you think we sing the lays we do? Why do you think we revere our scriptures, or ponder the life of the latter prophet?
Examples, Akamian realized. Examples of lives that enlightened, that solved. He knew this, but couldn't bring himself to say it. He was, after all, a sorcerer, an example of a life that solved nothing. Without a word, he rolled to his feet and strode into the darkness, not caring what the others thought. Suddenly, he needed darkness, solitude, shelter from Kellis. He was kneeling to duck into his tent when he realized that Zynemus had yet to hear his confession, that he was still alone with what he knew. Probably for the best. Skin spies in their midst, Kellis, the harbinger of the world's end, Zynemus would just think him mad. A woman's voice brought him up short.
I see the way you look at him.
Him, Kellis. Akamian glanced over his shoulder, saw Serway's willowy silhouette framed by the fire.
And how's that? He asked. She was angry. Her tone had betrayed that much. Was she jealous? During the day, while he and Kellis wandered the column, she walked with Zynemus's slaves.
You needn't fear, she said.
Akamian swallowed at the sour taste in his mouth. Earlier, Zynemus had passed parapta around instead of wine. Wretched drink. Fear what?
Loving him.
Akamian licked his lips, cursed his racing heart. You dislike me, don't you? Even in the gloom of long shadows, she seemed too beautiful to be real, like something that had stepped between the cracks of the world, something wild and white-skinned. For the first time, Akamian realized how much he desired her.
Only,
she hesitated, studied the flattened grasses at her feet. She raised her face, and for the briefest of instants, looked at him with Esmanet's eyes.
Only because you refuse to see, she murmured.
See what? Akamian wanted a cry, but she'd fled.
Akka? Kellis called in the fading dark. I heard someone weeping.
It's nothing,
Akamian croaked, his face still buried in his hands. At some point, he was no longer sure when, he'd crawled from his tent and huddled over the embers of their dying fire. Now dawn was coming.
Is it the dreams?
Akamian rubbed his face, heaved cool air into his lungs.
Tell him.
Yes, the dreams. That's it, the dreams.
He could feel the man stare down at him, but lacked the heart to look up. He flinched when Kellis placed a hand on his shoulder, but didn't pull away.
But it isn't the dreams, is it, Akka? It's something else, something more.
Hot tears parsed his cheeks, matted his beard. He said nothing.
You haven't slept this night. You haven't slept in many nights, have you?
Akamian looked over the surrounding encampment, across the canvas-congested slopes and fields, against a sky like cold iron, the pennants hung dead from their poles. Then he looked to Kellis. I see his blood in your face.
and it fills me with both hope and horror. The Prince of Atrathal frowned. So this is about me. I feared as much. Akamian swallowed and, without truly deciding to, threw the number sticks.
Yes, he said. But it's not so simple.
Why? What do you mean?
Among the many dreams my brother Schoolman and I suffer, there's one in particular that troubles us. It has to do with Anasarimber Kelmomus II, the High King of Cunaiori, with his death on the fields of Eleniot in the year 2146.
Akamian breathed deeply, rubbed angrily at his eyes.
You see, Kelmomus was the first great foe of the Consult, and the first and most glorious victim of the No-God, the first. He died in my arms, Kellis. He was my most hated, most cherished friend, and he died in my arms.
He scowled, waved his hands in confusion.
I mean in Siswatha's arms.
And this is what pains you? That I...
You don't understand! Just listen. Kelmomus spoke to me, to Siswatha, before he died. He spoke to all of us.
Akamian shook his head, cackled, pulled fingers through his beard.
In fact, he keeps speaking night after fucking night, dying time and again, and always for the first time, and he says...
Akamian looked up, suddenly unashamed of his tears. If he couldn't bear his soul before this man, so like Agensis, so like Inrau, then who?
He says that Ananasarimber, Kellis, will return at the end of the world.
Kellis's expression, normally so blessedly devoid of conflict, darkened. What are you saying, Akka?
Don't you see?
Akamian whispered.
You're the one, Kellis, the harbinger. The fact you're here means that it's starting all over again.
Sweet Sejanus.
The second apocalypse, Kellis. I'm talking about the second apocalypse. You are the sign.
Kellis's hand slipped from his shoulder.
But that doesn't make sense, Akka. The fact I'm here means nothing, nothing. Now I'm here and before I was in Atrathal, and if my bloodline reaches as far back as you say, then Ananasarimber has always been here, wherever that might be.
The Prince of Atrathal's eyes lost their focus, wrestled with unseen things. For a moment, the glamour of absolute self-possession faltered, and he looked like any man, overwhelmed by a precipitous turn of circumstance.
It's just a...
He paused, as if lacking the breath to continue.
A coincidence,
Akamian said, pressing himself to his feet. For some reason, he yearned to reach out, steady him with his embrace.
That's what I thought. I admit I was shocked when I first met you, but I never thought. It was just too mad. But then...
Then what?
I found them. I found the Consult. The night you and the others celebrated Proyas's victory over the Emperor, I was summoned to the Endymion Heights, by no less than Icuri Confis, and brought to the Imperial Catacombs. Apparently they'd found a spy in their midst, one that convinced the Emperor that sorcery simply had to be involved. But there was no sorcery, and the man they showed me was no ordinary spy.
How so?
For one, he called me Chigra, which is Siswatha's name in Agurtsoy, the perverted speech of the Srank. Somehow he could see Siswatha's trace within me. For another, he...
Akamian pursed his lips and shook his head.
He had no face. He was an abomination of the flesh, Kellis. A spy that can mimic the form of any man without sorcery or sorcery's mark. Perfect spies.
Somehow, somewhere... The Consult murdered the Emperor's Prime Council and had him replaced.
These things could be anywhere. Here in the Holy War, in the courts of the great factions. For all we know, they could be kings.
Or Shrya.
But how does that make me the Harbinger? Because it means the Consult has mastered the old science. Srank, Bashrags, dragons, all the abominations of the Inkoroi are artifacts of the Technae. the old science, created long, long ago when the non-men still ruled Eärwa. It was thought destroyed when the Inkoroi were annihilated by Kujara Kinwa, before the Tusk was even written, Kellis. But these skin spies are new. New artifacts of the old science. And if the consult has rediscovered the old science, there's a chance they know how to resurrect Mogg-Pharao. And that name stole his breath, winded him like a blow to the chest.
The No-God, Kellis said. Akamian nodded, swallowing as though his throat were sore.
Yes, the No-God.
And now that Ananasarimber has returned,
that chance has become a near certainty.
Kellis studied him for a stern moment, his expression utterly inscrutable. So what will you do?
My mission, Akamian said, is to observe the Holy War. But I've a decision to make, one that claws my heart every waking moment.
Which is?
Akamian tried hard to weather his student's glare, but there seemed to be something in his eyes, something incomparable, terrifying even.
I haven't told them about you, Kellis. I haven't told my brothers that the Kelmomian prophecy has been fulfilled. And so long as I don't tell them, I betray them. Siswatha, myself, he cackled again, and maybe even the world.
But why then? Kellis asked. Why haven't you told them?
Akamian took a deep breath. Because when I do, they'll come for you, Kellis.
Perhaps they should.
You don't know my brothers.
Crouching naked in the pre-dawn gloom of the tent he shared with Kellis, Nayor Uzgiotha peered at Serwe's sleeping face and used the tip of his knife to hook and draw away obscuring threads of her hair. The veil parted. He set aside the knife and ran two calloused fingers along her cheek. She twitched and sighed, nestled deeper in her blanket. So beautiful, so like his forgotten wife. Nayor watched her, as motionless and awake as she was, motionless and asleep. All the while, he listened to the voices outside, Kellis and the sorcerer, speaking nonsense. In some ways, it seemed a miracle. Not only had he traversed the length of the empire, he'd spat at the feet of the emperor, humiliated Ikuri Confis before his peers, and attained the rights and privileges of an Enrithi prince. Now he rode as a general in the greatest host he'd ever witnessed, a host that could crush cities, strike down nations, murder whole peoples, a host for memorialist songs, a holy war. And it was bent on storming Shaima, the stronghold of the Kishorum. The Kishorum! Ananasarimber Moengus was Kishorum. Despite the deranged scale of its ambition, the Dunyane's plan seemed to be working. In his dreams, Nayor had always come across Moengus alone. Sometimes there would be words, sometimes not. There would always be bleeding. But now those dreams seemed little more than juvenile fantasies. Kellis was right. After 30 years, Moengus would be far more than someone who could be cut down in some alley. He would be a potentate. His would be an empire. And how could it be any other way? He was Dunyane. Like his son, Kellis. Who could say how far Moengus's power reached? Certainly it encompassed the Kishorum and the Kianin. The question was only one of degree. But was that power with them now, in the Holy War? Did it include Kellis? Send them a son. What better way could a Dunyane overthrow his enemies? Already in their councils with Proyas, the Enrithi caste nobles fell instantly silent at the sound of Kellis's voice. Already they watched him when they thought him preoccupied, whispered when they thought he couldn't hear. And as pompous as they were, they deferred to him. Not the way men accede to rank or station, but the way men yield to those who possess something they need. Somehow, Kellis had convinced them he stood outside the circle of the commonplace, outside even the extraordinary. It was more than just his claim to have dreamt of the Holy War from afar, more than the nefarious ways he spoke to them, as though he were a father playing upon the well-known conceits of his children. It was what he said as well, the truths.
But the God favors the righteous,
In Gaiaban, the Palatine of Cathante had cried one night at council. At Nayor's insistence, they'd been discussing various strategies the Sapatashah of Shigek, Scorus, might use to undo them.
Sejanus himself!
And you, Kellis interrupted. Are you righteous? The air in the royal pavilion became tense with a strange, aimless expectation.
We are the righteous, yes,
the Palatine of Cathante replied.
If not, then what in Juru's name are we doing here?
Indeed, Kellis said. What are we doing here? Nayur glimpsed Lord Gedeki turning to Zynemus, a worried glance. Wary, in Gaiaban, purchased time by sipping his ampoy.
Raising arms against the heathen, what else?
So we raise arms against the heathen because we're righteous?
And because they're wicked!
Kellis smiled with stern compassion. He who's righteous is he who's not found wanting in the ways of the god. Isn't this what Sejanus himself writes?
Yes, of course.
And who finds men wanting in the ways of the god? Other men? The Palatine of Cathante paled.
No, he said. Only the god and his prophets.
So we're not righteous then?
Yes, I mean no.
Baffled, Ngaiaban looked to Kellis, a horrible frankness revealed in his face.
I mean, I no longer know what I mean.
Concessions. Always exacting concessions. Accumulating them. Then you understand, Kellis said, his voice now deep and preternaturally resonant, a voice that seemingly spoke from everywhere. A man can never judge himself righteous, Lord Palatine. He can only hope. And it's this that gives meaning to our actions. In raising arms against the heathen, we're not the priest before the altar, we're the victim. It means nothing to offer up another to the god. So we make offerings of ourselves. Make no mistake, all of you. We wager our souls. We leap into the black. This pilgrimage is our sacrifice. Only afterward will we know whether we've been found wanting. The mutter of startled, even wondrous assent.
Well said, Kellis, Proyas had declared. Well said.
All men see from where they stand, and somehow Kellis saw farther than any other man. He stood upon a different ground, greater as though he occupied the heights of every soul, and though none of the Enrithi noblemen dared speak this intimation, they felt it, all of them. Nayur could see it in the cast of their eyes, hear it in the timbre of their voices, the first shadows of awe, the wonder that made men small. Nayur knew these secretive passions all too well. To watch Kellis ply these men was to witness the shameful record of his own undoing at the hands of Moengus. Sometimes the urge to cry out in warning almost overpowered him. Sometimes Kellis seemed such an abomination that the gulf between Skilvendi and Enrithi threatened to disappear, particularly where Proyas was concerned. Moengus had preyed upon the same vulnerabilities, the same conceits. If Nayur shared these things with these men, how different could he be? Sometimes crimes seemed crimes, no matter how ludicrous the victim. But only sometimes. For the most part, Nayur merely watched with a numb kind of incredulity. He no longer heard Kellis speak, so much as observed him cut and carve, whittle and hew, as though the man had somehow shattered the glass of language and fashioned knives from the pieces. This word to anger, so that word might open. This look to embarrass, so that smile might reassure. This insight to remind, so that truth might injure, heal, or astonish. How easy it must have been for Moengus, one stripling lad, one chieftain's wife. Images, stark and dry, of the steppe assailed him. The other women tearing at his mother's hair, clawing at her face, clubbing her with rocks, stabbing her with sticks.
Mother!
A bawling infant hoisted from her yaksh, tossed into the all-cleansing fire. His blond-haired half-brother. The stone faces of the men turning away from his look.
How could he let it happen again?
How could he stand by and watch? How could... Still crouching next to Serwe, Nayur looked down, shocked to see that he'd been stabbing the ground with his knife. The bone-white reeds of the mat were snapped and severed about a small pit of black. He shook his black mane, breathed as though punishing air. Always these thoughts. Always. Remorse? For outlanders? Concern for mewling peacocks? Especially Proyas? So long as what comes before remained shrouded, Kellis had said on their trek across the Jayonati steppe, so long as men are already deceived, what does it matter? And what did it matter, making fools of fools? What mattered was whether the man made a fool of him. This was the sharp edge upon which his every thought should bleed. Did the Dunyain speak true? Was he truly his father's assassin? I walk with the whirlwind. He could never forget. He had only his hatred to preserve him. And Serwe? The voices from outside had trailed into silence. He could hear that weeping fool of a sorcerer clearing his nose outside. Then Kellis pressed through the flap into the dim interior. His eyes flashed from Serwe to the knife to Nayor's face. You heard, he said in flawless Skilvendi. Even after all this time, hearing him speak thus made Nayur's skin prickle.
This is a camp of war, he replied. Many heard.
No, they slept. Nayur knew the futility of debate. He knew the Dunyain. So he said nothing, rooted through his scattered belongings for his breeches. Serwe complained and kicked at her blankets. Do you recall that first time we spoke in your yaksh? Kellis asked.
Of course.
Nayor replied, pulling on his breeches.
I cursed that day with every waking breath.
That witch stone you threw to me.
You mean my father's koray?
Yes. Do you still have it? Nayor peered at him through the gloom.
But you know I do.
And how would I know?
You know.
Nayor dressed in silence while Kellis roused Serwe.
But the horns,
she complained, burying her head.
I haven't heard the horns.
Nayor laughed abruptly, deep and full-throated.
Treacherous work, he said, now speaking in Shaik.
And what's that? Kellis replied. More for Serwe's benefit than anything, Nayor realized. The Dunyain knew what he meant. He always knew.
Killing sorcerers.
Just then, the horn sounded. Late spring, 4111. Year of the Tusk, the Andiamine Heights. Zorias stood from the baths, walked up the marble steps to where the slaves waited with towels and scented oils, and for the first time in days he could feel it move him. Harmony, the providence of auspicious deities. He looked up with mild surprise when the Empress, his mother, appeared from the dark recesses of the chamber.
Tell me, mother,
he said without looking at her extravagant figure.
Do you simply happen upon me at inopportune moments?
He turned to her as the slaves gently toweled his groin.
Or is this, too, something you measure?
The Empress bowed her head slightly, as though she were Shrya, an equal.
I've brought you a gift, Zorias,
she said, gesturing to the dark-haired girl at her side. With a flourish, her eunuch, the giant Pizathalus, opened the girl's robe and drew it away. Beneath, she was as white-skinned as a Galioth, as naked as the Emperor, and almost as splendid. Gifts from Mother. They underscored the treachery of gifts from those who were not one's tributaries. Such gifts weren't gifts at all, in fact. Such gifts always demanded exchange. Zorias couldn't remember when Estrella had started bringing these men and women to him, these surrogates. She had the eye of a whore, his mother. He would grant her that. She knew, unerringly, what would please him.
You are a venal witch, mother, he said, admiring the terrified girl. Was there ever a son so fortunate as me?
But Estrella said only,
Scarce is dead.
Zorias looked at her momentarily, then returned his attention to the slaves who'd begun rubbing him with oil.
Something is dead, he replied, suppressing a shudder. We know not what.
And why wasn't I told?
I knew you'd hear of it soon enough.
He sat upon the chair brought for him, and his body slaves began combing his hair with more oils, filing his nails.
You always do, he added.
The Kisharim,
Estrella said after a pause. But of course.
Then they know. The Kisharim know of your plans.
It's of little consequence. They knew already.
Have you become such a vulgar fool, Zarius? I thought that after this you would be ready to reconsider.
Reconsider what, Mother?
This mad pact you have made with the heathen, what else?
Silence, Mother.
Zarius glanced nervously at the girl, but it was plain that she didn't speak a word of Shaik.
This isn't to be uttered aloud, ever again. Do you hear me?
But the Kisharim, Zarius, think of it. At your bosom all these years, wearing the face of Scaeus, the Emperor's only confidant, that vile tongue-clucking poison for counsel, all these years, Zarius, sharing the heart of your ambitions with an obscenity.
Zarius had thought of this, had been able to think of little else these past days. At night he dreamed of faces, faces like fists, of Gain Kelty, who had died so absurdly. And then there was the question that struck with such force it never failed to jar him from the tedium of his routines.
Are there others? Others like it? You lecture the educated, Mother. You know that in all things there's a balance to be struck, an exchange of vulnerabilities for advantages. You taught me this.
But the Empress didn't relent. The old bitch never relented.
The Kisharim have had your heart in their clutches, Zarius. Through you, they have sopped on the very marrow of the Empire. And you would let this, an offense like no other, go unpunished now, when the gods have delivered to you the instrument of your vengeance? You'd still pull the holy war up short? If you spare Shimer, Zarius, you spare the Kisharim.
Silence!
His scream pealed throughout the chamber. Estrella laughed fiercely.
My naked son, she said. My poor naked son.
Zarius leapt to his feet, shouldered past the circle of his slaves, his look wounded, quizzical.
This isn't like you, Mother. You were never one to cower before damnation. Is it because you grow old, Tell me. What's it like to stand upon the precipice, to feel your womb wither, to watch the eyes of your lovers grow shy with hidden disgust?
He'd struck from impulse and found vanity, the only way he knew to injure his mother. But there was no bruise in her reply.
There comes a time, Zarius, when you care nothing for your spectators. The spectacles of beauty are like the baubles of ceremony, for the young, the stupid. The act, Zarius, the act makes mere ornament of all things. You'll see.
Then why the cosmetics, Mother? Why have your body slaves truss you up like an old whore to the feast?
She looked at him blankly.
Such a monstrous son,
she whispered.
As monstrous as his mother,
Zarius added, laughing cruelly.
Tell me, now that your debauched life is nearly spent, are you filled with regret, Mother?
Estrella looked away across the steaming bathwaters.
Regret is inevitable, Zarius.
These words struck him.
Perhaps. Perhaps it is,
he replied, moved for some reason to sudden pity. There had been a time when he and his mother had been close, but Estrella could be intimate with only those she possessed. She no longer possessed him. The thought of this touched Zarius. To lose such a godlike son.
Always these savage exchanges, eh, Mother? I do repent them. I would have you know that much.
He looked at her pensively, chewed his bottom lip.
But speak of Shaima again, and I will put your platitude to the test. You will regret. Do you understand this?
I understand, Zarius.
There was malice in her eyes when she met his gaze, but Zarius ignored it. A concession, any concession, was a triumph when dealing with the Empress. Zarius studied the young girl instead, her taut breasts upswept like swallow's wings, her soft weave of pubic hair. Aroused, he held out his hand and she came to him reluctantly. He led her to a nearby couch and reclined, stretched out before her.
Do you know what to do, child? He asked.
She opened her lithe legs, straddled him. Tears streamed down her cheeks. Trembling, she lowered upon his member. Zarius gasped. It was like sinking into a warm, unbroken peach. If the world harbored obscene things like the Kisharim, it harbored also such sweet fruits. The old empress turned to leave.
"Will you not stay, mother?"
Zarius called, his voice thick.
"Watch your son enjoy this gift of yours?"
Astraea hesitated.
"No, Zarius."
"But you will, mother. The emperor is difficult to please. You must instruct her."
There was a pause, filled only by the girl's whimper.
"But certainly, my son,"
Astraea said at length and walked grandly over to the couch. The rigid girl flinched when she grasped her hand and drew it down to Zarius's scrotum.
"Gently, child," she cooed. "Shh, no weeping."
Zarius groaned and arched into her, laughed when she chirped in pain. He gazed into his mother's painted face, suspended over the girl's shoulder, whiter even than the porcelain, Galioth's skin, and he burned with that old illicit thrill. He felt a child again, careless. All was as it should be. The gods were auspicious indeed.
"Tell me, Zarius,"
his mother said huskily,
"how was it that you discovered Scarce